Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Brent Plate, professor of religious studies at Hamilton College, about his wonderful book, Religion and Film, Cinema and the Recreation of the World. As each frame of a film goes by, we witness a new world that is situated in space and time. This process of world-making happens through the cinematic lens, but also through the myths and rituals of religious traditions. Or so argues Brent Plate in this wonderful new book, Religion and Film. In this short work, Plate sets out to create a critical religious film theory and demonstrates how understanding religion and film can help us comprehend the other in more nuanced ways. Through a close examination of mise-en-scène, editing, and cinematics, we discover the interrelationship of the world we live in and the one on the screen. Plate reveals that film serves many of the same functions myth and ritual do in defining space and time. Both Hollywood blockbusters and avant-garde films present a way of understanding the world and reveal a new visual ethics. Plate also tells us what happens when film leaves the movie theater and re-ritualizes contemporary experience. In our conversation, we discuss film techniques, Star Wars, Blue Velvet, The Matrix, the sensual aspects of religion, the altar and the screen, ethics, aesthetics, myth, ritual, and Plate talks about his role in developing new features in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. Without further ado, here's the interview.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Brent Plate about his wonderful new-ish book, Religion and Film, Cinema and the Recreation of the World. Welcome, Brent. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah. I really enjoyed your book, and it actually took me in some directions I wasn't expecting from some of the other literature I've read on religion and film. So I'm looking forward to getting into those details. But before we get into the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in religion, how you got interested in film, and how you kind of became one of the leaders in this field?
Yeah, sure. I'm visiting associate professor of religious studies at Hamilton College, upstate New York, sitting here waiting for a hurricane to come through our backyard and all that kind of stuff, but things are good for now. I've been here for a few years. I used to teach at Texas Christian University for several years. I taught at University of Vermont for a couple of years and the Atlanta College of Art. So I've tried a different number of different places, number of different kinds of students, and really enjoyed all of them. And I find in teaching religious studies that having been able to use things like film and the arts and music and popular culture in general, of course, just allows some kind of inroads into teaching religious studies that, opening a big old book doesn't quite do the same thing for. Not that we don't open some big old books, but, some other ways to do it. So a lot of it is just my own personal research, but it's very much coupled. It's always my teaching and my research writing have gone together, sort of side by side, and sort of stretching farther back. In graduate school, I did undergraduate degree in philosophy, and then did a couple graduate degrees, master's degrees in sort of Christian theology, but always linking Christian theology with some sort of arts and media kind of thing. And then by the time I got to my PhD, I just really moved away from, I just got more into comparative religions and sort of theories of religion and theories of modern art and tried to figure out how those things could fit together. And so did a lot of work on contemporary video art and installation art and, still very much appreciate that, but I've sort of stopped researching in that more and more. So now I've moved in, and all along I've just always loved film and kind of began reading, you know, back in the 90s as I was going through graduate school, began, you know, finding a group of people who were kind of doing some work in religion and film. And it was about the time, Oswald Martin's screening The Sacred came out and Margaret Miles' Seeing is Believing. And there were a few others before there. John May had done a couple books. And most of the early stuff was on the European auteurs. You know, there's always some stuff on Tarkovsky and Fellini and Bergman and people like that, and which, you know, still like love all those directors. Then another wave came in and sort of looked at the popular popular film, and I was kind of in between. I like the art house cinema, but also like the popular stuff, and began to kind of teach in a way that incorporated both of those, and began to kind of research and realize I could actually write a paper and get it, you know, get something published on watching films, and some other readings as well. So that was kind of motivated me, and the students seemed to like it, and you know, the administrators at the schools I taught at liked it because classes filled up in general. So sort of a win-win situation. Of course, the problem, you know, is always trying to convince students that, you know, we're not just here to watch movies. We're here to think about movies and write critically about movies. And that's where the real rub comes. But it's been fun to do. So along the way, really film, I've done a few publications in film and religion and film, but I've always sort of for my own life, I've seen it as a side hobby, you know, something that was just one of the ways that the kind of interests I have in religious studies got manifest. It's just that I think a number of publishers were out looking for books in religion and film, and you know, students kept coming and wanting to do projects in religion and film. So I've kind of kept up that research and kept up that publishing along the line. But I really sort of see myself more as someone who looks at comparative religions through material culture. That's really how I define myself more specifically. So I'm interested in the sights and the smells and the sounds and the touches that different religious traditions encourage in their practitioners, and the way the practitioners engage the senses and engage with material objects as part of their religious traditions. And I find that to be much more of a primary thing than reading the texts and talking about, you know, God's omnipotence or omniscience or the problem of evil. I find kind of the basic sensual material encounters to be really the primary basis of religion, far before the kind of abstractions of the angels and demons and attributes of God. Not that those aren't important. It's just a different way of approaching the various comparative religions. So then along the line, just been doing work on film. And so to get back to the film stuff, I did a few books, edited books on religion and film in various ways, and tried to look at you know, world cinema, and tried to suggest that it's not just Hollywood that's doing films with some sort of religious interest, but we begin to look around the world. We see a huge production in many different places with religious themes, and the problem is, you know, scholars in North America certainly kind of just don't see it because we're so dominated by our Hollywood view of the world and whatever's playing at the local multiplex that we forget that, you know, how much amazing stuff is going on in other parts of the world. So I edited a few books along those lines, and then it sort of finally led me to think I need to just write my own book. So I began talking with Wallflower Press in London, and the editor there, Yoram Allen, who's a great guy and a great editor. And he was working with Wallflower and doing a Shortcuts series. And these are all short books that are, you know, I can't remember page or word number, something like 30,000 words, 35,000 words, maybe. It's, you know, they're meant to be very short books, and mine was certainly short. I mean, I think it's with everything, it's a little over 100 pages, so it's a small book. So the book gave me a chance to sort of put together some of my own ideas that I'd been thinking about as I'd been working in the other areas along the way.
Yeah, and you can see how your broader interest in material culture or kind of the central aspects of religion come through in your reading of film. Maybe since a lot of people might not be familiar with kind of this field of religion and film studies, maybe you could tell us what your book does not do, kind of outline the field for us a little bit, and then describe how this book kind of takes a different direction.
What it doesn't do, and I was just noticing, I was looking through some other books, where a few of us will be at the AAR this year, and we're running a session on looking back, facing forward, something like that. It's sort of a trying to be up looking at the state of religion and film studies, you know, where they are right now. And so they'll have four of us there who've done books on the topic in recent years. And so John Lydon's book, Film as Religion, from about 10 years ago now, then my book, and then two brand new books, one by Antonio Cisson and on world cinema and the theology and the human, and one by Sheila Nair on orality and literacy in Indian, South Asian films. So the four of us will be talking. And so I've been thinking about these, you know, variety of sort of going back and looking at this history of the field in preparation for the AAR, realizing so many of the other books chapters are based on individual films. So, you know, here's a film, I'm going to talk about this film for the whole chapter, and here's the themes that come up out of the film. And some of them might have been motivated by particular interests. You know, I want to talk about evil, so I'm going to pick, you know, this film to talk about evil and the problem of evil. What I wanted to do is get away from the idea of film as a whole, as a kind of a cohesive narrative, which, you know, certainly it is. I wanted to sort of chop it up and pay more attention to individual scenes and focus our attention on the, you know, specific audiovisual dimensions of the format. You know, what does it look like? What does it sound like? What are they wearing? Where is it set? You know, how tall are some of the people? Where is the camera? And questions like that. And how, you know, how quickly is it edited? And what is the strategies for editing? And by looking at just individual scenes rather than entire movies, I think it sort of freed me up to develop themes in religion more broadly. So I, you know, one chapter takes on myth, one chapter takes on ritual, and so forth. So it allowed a kind of different way of doing things. I think the other thing is, you know, like I said before, I think the difference is that I tried to mix up. Some of them are very popular films. You know, I talk about The Matrix and Star Wars in there. Some of them are more kind of art house films. Some of them kind of were crossovers. Films like Chocolat with Johnny Depp and Juliette Binoche were kind of an art house film, but kind of, you know, got fairly popular as well. And then some avant-garde film, you know, things by Stan Brakhage and others that, you know, really nobody, almost nobody in religious studies has really written about at all or paid much attention to, even though it's deeply religious work. So I tried to, you know, break from those are kind of the two main ways. I think the mixture of the varieties of film that I incorporated, as well as not doing films as a whole, looking at particular scenes and letting the themes run the course of the conversation. So I wanted to talk about myth, so I went through several films to look at myth, or I wanted to talk about ritual. So rather than being bound by one film and having to stick to that, I tried to open that up.
We keep repeating this word religion. Often, and for centuries, religion has been thought of in ways of doctrines, of teachings, of beliefs, of things like this. Mm-hmm. You propose that we understand it as worlds. You use the word worlds, and you talk about this
right.
Idea of world making. Can you kind of talk about this idea of world making and how that relates to religion?
Yeah, I was really it really comes to me through the work of William Payden when I was at the University of Vermont working side by side with Bill there, and he did a book I think it's 20 years old now called Religious Worlds, and he really pulls on other thinkers. He's really doing sort of there's Durkheim in there, and certainly some Geertz and folks like that who are sort of proposing this idea of you know, that religion creates a world, and it's a world that we live in. happen, and there's multiple worlds, and they sort of overlap and they intersect, and we don't all the idea that I think are just sort of very powerful in terms of the way we organize time and space. We all live in different worlds, you know, sort of simultaneously. Our next door neighbor is celebrating a different year. You know, if you're working on a Jewish calendar, or working on a Muslim calendar, or working on a Buddhist calendar, right? It's not the same year everywhere. It's different years, and you can be walking next to somebody down the street and actually living in a different year. You know, I just sort of became infatuated by that idea, you know, that we could do such a thing. And so the idea of a religious world is that it's encompassing, it's something we live in. And this, of course, is important because, you know, for my own work, religion is bodily based. You know, it's what we do with our bodies and our senses. And we create worlds by the ways we see and touch and smell and taste. And so to be able to think about that provides, I think, a fairly natural parallel then with approaches to film. And films, what films do, I think each one creates its own world. And so the whole idea is that we enter into the world of the film, right? At the beginning, the narrator, the guy with a deep voice on the trailers always says, in a world where, you know, you're bound to be free or something like that. And he's always saying that, you know, in a world where, and that's the introduction to these films. And they're not talking about religion. They're talking about, you know, very self-consciously, the film brings you into another world. So I wanted to sort of toggle back and forth between the way films do that and the way religions do that in order to sort of hopefully illuminate both sides. That if we think about films and we sort of get the way, oh yeah, this, you know, things are a little bit different here in this world. You know, the ugly guys get the beautiful girls, you know, and those kinds of things that just don't, you know, maybe don't happen in the real world unless you're a rock star. And so thinking about that and then taking that back into religion and thinking, oh yeah, religions, you know, aren't just about doctrine and reading texts. They're about living in worlds. It's about our space and our time, you know, organized. Our space is organized in one direction. You know, maybe it points towards Jerusalem or Mecca or some other place, and our whole orientation is different because of the religious worlds that we live within. So it's a very physical concept, I think, which I liked a lot. And so the goal was really to adapt. I think sort of filtered a lot through a very, very clearly, you know, influenced by Payden's sort of take on all of that. And Payden, I, you know, love, still use it all the time for my classes. Payden's book, Religious Worlds, as ways to kind of think about religion in these broader categories. So sometimes teaching world religions, and you know, you get to these kind of older models where you do Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and you know, yeah, we have a sacred text, we have a founder, and all that kind of stuff. And then you get to Buddhism, and you've got the founder, but you don't have quite the single sacred text, you don't have quite the same structure, and there's sort of not the omnipotent God there. And so it caused, you know, for so many years, caused the Westerners to say, well, it's not a religion, it's a way of life. I sort of thought, well, so religion's not a way of life. You know, what a strange concept to sort of contrast religion with a way of life. And I think what Worlds does is it brings that together, right? So it says, you know, religion is a way of life. That, you know, you can't think of it any, I mean, you can't think of it other ways, but it certainly doesn't exist that way for the way people actually experience it.
So part of this world making process how you kind of structure parts of the book is you talk about the role of myth and the role of ritual. Can you talk about how this plays into world making?
Yeah, so I think the introductions are so important when we're dealing with myth, right? The beginnings of the Hebrew scriptures and Christian scriptures, you know, in the beginning, you always got to have the setting, and a myth is a good story, you know, one way or another, it's telling a story and telling a narrative, and it's got to have a beginning, and it's got to have a setting. So, you know, in the beginning, when God was creating the heavens and the earth, you know, we get the time and the place, and it just, you know, parallels so well the prologue to Star Wars, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And that, you know, film is introducing us to these other worlds, and it's just that introduction of the setting, you know, where are you and when are you, you know, and the films introduce us. It's the thing of all stories, you know, it doesn't have to be myth stories. It doesn't have to be anything else. Stories are always doing that. What film does is it tells, or what religion does, and some films do, is tell these grander stories, you know, about, something that's pertaining to all of us, you know, in the beginning, you know, implied is it's the beginning of everything. The beginning of the world is beginning. So I think myth sets up the stories in that way. And by looking at the introduction, so what I do is in the book and what I do in classes as well is I play a bunch of, you know, clips from films, show the first 2 minutes of films. I think in the book I talked about Blue Velvet, I talked about Star Wars, and these similar kinds of introductions to the worlds that borrow this mythic language, but also a visual kind of vocabulary where up means one thing and down means another thing. And there's this, you know, the here below is in connection with the up above, and we work out our life in between these kind of two realms in this medieval cosmology. And film replicates that. It borrows these sort of cosmic mythological structures where if you want to make a point about something, you tilt the camera up to the clouds, up to the sky, and you're sort of saying something cosmic about, you know, the here below when you do that. So trying to translate the mythic, the storytelling of mythology that has been going on for, you know, thousands and thousands of years around the world, trying to translate that into a visual vocabulary. What is the camera person doing when they're moving the camera side to side, or when they're going up and down, and how that impacts our way of seeing, introducing ourselves into this world, and inserting ourselves as the spectators, as the audience, into this world where we know what is up and we know what is down, we know what's to our left and know what's to our right. So I think the structures of mythology, of storytelling, of setting, of putting ourselves in a place and a time and trying to get back to that time by retelling the story, again, it's kind of a similar thing that film is doing. Religion and film are analogous then on these kinds of methods. And then, of course, the question is, you know, what – and then myth, of course, is about, you know, these creation myths about the beginnings of things long ago, but there's also the hero myths, which I didn't deal with much in the book and sort of ran out of space on that and might be for some other project. But of course, every other film is a hero myth in some sort of way, shape, or form. So the mythologies have been providing these stories as Hollywood is sort of finally figuring out in the last 10 years, of course, it's just sort of whole-scale borrowing of the ancient myths from around the world and retelling these stories. And, you know, you don't really need an original idea when the story from 3,000 years ago works quite well. Let's just, you know, get a screenwriter to adapt the old story. And, you know, we've got the narrative structure in place. Let's just go with that. So the storyline is there. The myths provide a storyline that the films can replicate and put into a particular audiovisual language. And then similarly with rituals, similar kinds of things that you hear the anthropologists talk about ritual. And they talk about ritual as providing a frame, you know, set apart time and a set apart space. And, of course, that's exactly what films are doing too. They're setting apart a particular time and a particular space. So again, the idea of analogy, I think what I was trying to do throughout the first two chapters anyway on myth and ritual is to provide analogies to say film is analogous to myth, film is analogous to ritual. The way it structures, and getting back to these root things of space and time. Space and time is altered in the film. Space and time is altered in a religious world. Hopefully that makes sense there.
Yeah, and in the book you're definitely successful in kind of delineating this, and I you know, it makes total sense that these two are analogous, but it's not as obvious as after reading your book it seems.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about this idea of mise-en-scene and how this figures into kind of portraying mythologies? Because when we think of myth, we also think of stories, right? Just what the story tells us. But,
exactly.
But how does this figure?
Exactly. Yeah, so I think one of the things that I think my book did a little bit differently than most of the others. Other books have certainly compared, you know, mythologies to film, of course, and it's kind of a natural thing there. But to get more, you know, into the details of the scene, you know, of how things are set up, you know, so to include things like, so in mise-en-scene, you're dealing with things like props and costume and lighting, and it's sort of the look of everything that goes into the frame, you know, this color scheme that's in there, the setup, the placement of characters in relation to each other. And of course, you have kind of the set, the, you know, production designers are working with the camera people and the directors, and they're all sort of thinking about this together. But to look at the, you know, does a color mean something? The fact that a certain person is wearing a certain color at a certain time. And yes, it does. I get in these conversations with people who say, oh, you know, it's just, you know, the acting as if the actor just sort of came off the streets, woke up in the morning, and, you know, she said, I think I'm going to wear a pink dress today. And that's what she wore onto the set. You know, well, you know, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's, they're highly created. There's, you know, hundreds of people running around trying to figure out what's the right color, what's the length of the dress, you know, how is it going to, you know, appear on the person? These are not, none of these things, nothing within a film is accidental. And, you know, trying to convince, kind of surprising how difficult that can be to convince people, you know, that it's not just by chance that person was wearing that color. And that, you know, it may be as simple as that color makes them stand out from the other people. You know, and you see it in certain films. Of course, Schindler's List had this, you know, wonderful use of the sort of pink coat, the sort of hand-tinted, hand-colored pink coat that sort of, you know, created this leitmotif throughout the whole film, and it kept appearing at different places. And the use of color there, of course, a fairly blatant use of color, of course, but evocative nonetheless. You don't have to say anything. You know, all you have to do is show this coat in a few different places. You realize what is happening. This mini story is going on in Schindler's List just by these. You know, I can't even remember. It's four or five images of this coat, this little girl's coat. And you get a whole story just out of that. It could be a short, it could have been a 2-minute short film, and just showing these things without any words at all. So there's a powerful story going on with the images. And, you know, so I'm trying to get my students to read these images and to think, what difference does it make? So one of the things I use, the example in The Matrix, when the characters come out of the, you know, the so-called real world into the Matrix, they're always wearing either, you know, leather or rubber, you know, this kind of fetishistic clothes. But they're all, you know, the idea of these, they're second skins. And it's sort of as they're avataring, you know, they become these avatars in the Matrix. What they're wearing at the same time as a second skin. They're a lot, pretty much most of it is leather, right? So they're wearing the skin of another animal when they go out there. So there's this layering effect going on that you know, emphasizes the otherworldness of the Matrix and the real world within the film. Again, these kind of things are, you know, very much done on purpose, right? There's a lot of thought that goes into these things. And you know, just to think about characters, just to look at the placement of characters. I think about a clip I show to my students from Apocalypse Now, and we're introduced to the Robert Duvall character, and the camera, when we first really get an introduction to him, they're sort of around a campfire at night. And camera is really low to the ground, and it's looking up, and all the sort of soldiers are kind of sitting down, and Duvall's kind of standing there above him, and he's sort of this dominating figure, you know, above the rest. And he gives this, you know, hard-ass, masculine warrior kind of speech. And, you know, it's just so the visuality is re-emphasizing the words he's saying. And of course, most of us will go away and remember the words that he said and maybe not the way it was set up. But both of these things are equally important in the whole structure of that. So I think by focusing on mise-en-scène, it allows us to, allows us to kind of think specifically about individual scenes rather than this duration of the narrative. You know, what happens when this happens and this happens and this happens? To think about space as much as time. Mise-en-scène allows these kind of snapshots to discover what's going on in the space of the film. I think that's kind of a problem film studies scholars, I think, fall into the same kind of trap that people from religious studies approaching film do. We want to think about it as this duration. We tend towards time, and we tend to think of the whole story, and we put it in verbal terms of story rather than thinking about these individual spaces of the scenes. And so I think we need to be a little more attentive to the visual spaces that the films are creating for us.
Yeah, and in the second chapter, you focus on the role of cinematography in creating this space. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, a bit of sort of what I was saying before. The beginning of Star Wars, of course, you've got that prologue a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Right, you've got wonderful mythic language. Tells you the when and the where. Of course, like all mythic language, it's always ambiguous language, right? It doesn't tell you, in the year 1855, at sunset, such and such happened. It's, a long time ago, and it's this ambiguous, how long is a long time ago? And of course, if you're, my daughter in the car, and we're sort of driving, running around doing errands, and like, oh, how long till we get there? It's 10 minutes, right, to get over to the next town and go to the store in the next town. 10 minutes is a long time to my daughter at this point. And of course, to a historian, it might be, a few hundred years is a long time. Or, if you're a paleontologist, a few million years is a long time. So what does it mean to say long? It's totally ambiguous language. The important thing, it was before. Star Wars tells us a long time ago. So something that happened in the past. I'm not sure how long ago it was. And it throws us off because it's kind of sci-fi. And there's all these things in this world that, laser beams that we can't do in our world, even though it was before in time. It's this curious setting. So it introduces that language, but then it immediately, what you see in Star Wars, the beginning is shot of the stars. It's a black screen with just stars there, and then you get the triumphant sort of prologue telling you what happened. And then right after the words trail off the screen at the beginning of Star Wars, the camera just stays still for a second. You're just sort of left with this really nice music. All the percussive, heavy percussive music drops out, and you've got this piccolo, and it's just very gentle for about 3 seconds, and you're just looking at the stars, and here's the cosmos. Everything is right in the cosmos. And then the percussion starts up, and the camera tilts down, and you see the spaceships, fighting each other, shooting lasers at each other, and we see the top of a planet sort of emerge, and we're not really sure which planet it is or where it is, but obviously chaos and war are happening. So in a very simple kind of way, it's doing this visually. The camera points up to the stars, and here's the cosmos, right? Here's the ordered world, and then it tilts down to so up above is the star, down below is the wars. And, within 5 seconds, you have encapsulated the title and the sort of introduction to the thing just by a camera movement. Up is the stars, up is the cosmos, down is the wars, down is the chaos. And that, one simple little camera move kind of inaugurates that kind of thing. So again, the placement of the camera, shots from far away, close up shots, and then, getting into, examples of the face, then close ups of the face and what those might entail and the power and the emotions that, of course, certain camera people and directors are able to get out of performers, by close up of, Greta Garbo's face or, Emily Watson in Breaking the Waves, I think, is a really good example of that. Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves, his constant close-ups of Emily Watson's face and her eyes, just to just sort of mesmerizing these shots in the middle of it. So that's, you know, again, part of the feel, the emotional pull of the film relies on those kind of close-ups, you know, the decision about where to put the camera, how to frame the scene, and what kind of resonances that might have with the audience.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of editing? Because this becomes important in our sense of time.
Yeah, exactly. So the I read somewhere that, you know, your average 90-minute action adventure film has something like 3,000 or 4,000 cuts in it. You know, the shot is changing 3,000 times. So it's like every, you know, seconds. I mean, every couple seconds, you're seeing a new image, and it's just flashing by you constantly. And so there's the tempo, right? Is you get part of it's not just blowing cars up; it's blowing cars up from five different angles and shooting them one at another, you know, at you as you're watching it. So it's meant to kind of disrupt your sense of calm and keep you, you know, literally on the edge of your seat. So editing, you know, the perfection of editing, I really sort of believe is the most. Probably, and I'm not alone in this, but the most powerful dimension of film, that's the most probably understated by most of us kind of novices from the outside of the industry. It's just extremely powerful on our sense of time, on our sense of perception, on the way we encounter the worlds that are on screen. So, you know, doing it slow edits, you know, where you just let a scene unfold. Woody Allen, I think, is, you know, part of what makes Woody Allen films just sort of fun to watch is he lets his characters talk. And, he's pulling on a long European tradition of doing this, Bergman especially and others. But, you know, he sets up two characters and will just kind of – he gives them a script, but then they kind of just talk to each other. And it's – the camera will follow people, you know, around the streets of Manhattan for, you know, a full minute or two before he pulls the camera away from them. And you're – So there you get embedded into a conversation. You know, the world that he's creating is the city streets, you know, walking around, but also the conversation between two people. And that's the kind of world you get pulled into in Woody Allen and other people as well. How are you going to work with the editing? So that, and again, I think there's a lot of direct parallels and analogies to the way religious rituals work. And certainly if you compare perhaps, you know, an older form of Christianity, more traditional form of Christianity, and, you know, the rites and the rituals are sort of prolonged and they sort of take a lot of time and they're sort of drawn out and it's meant to put you in a state of calm. Whereas the newer, you know, we look at the emergent church or, you know, other kind of evangelical, you know, in these mega churches, you know, it's like a music video. It's just sort of, it's constantly changing. They're playing music. You know, there's multiple things going on at the same time. It's not editing in the strict sense of it, but the sense of what editing does is provides a rhythm and a pace to a film. And a similar kind of thing you can analogize then to religious rituals and the performance of them, because some are slow and religious rituals and some are fast, and we get a different feeling coming away from them based on the slowness and the fastness of it. It changes our pace, changes our, you know, I mean, we can actually go in and we can take the pulse and take the heart rate of people watching a film, and you know, these things impact us. You know, they're not just escapes; they actually change our body. Our heart beats differently when we watch an action film and when we watch a sort of, you know, documentary nature film, you know, or something just very slow moving. You know, literally, our body is affected, is completely touched by these films, and our heart will move differently. Our nervous system moves differently. Based on these images and the sounds that we're hearing. So editing is kind of at the heart of a lot of that, and the pace of things. Of course, it's about music. Of course, it's about what's shown on scene as well. But editing provides a certain sense of pace. And I think then that, you know, that sort of what I also tried to do a little bit, though, you know, it's just too small a book to do this, is to try to take this back, use these kinds of models for looking at film to go back and, you know, become an anthropologist and look at religious ritual and to say, you know, to think more deeply about the aesthetic framing of time and space in rituals. You know, is it meant to be fast? Is it meant to be slow? What's going on with the changes in those kinds of things?
And in the third chapter, you do focus on this idea of the body. And I think you use the term visual ethics. I'm wondering if you could talk about this idea of ethics and how that's encountered through film.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something I've been toying with for a number of years, and actually was worked with a couple of people at Case Western, probably 5 years ago now. We actually set up a symposium one weekend there on visual ethics, and we sort of had this plan to kind of launch this kind of new field of study. I mean, you see the term around visual ethics, and it's usually been predominantly under the guise of journalism and photojournalism, you know, and how much do photojournalists, you know, especially in an age of Photoshop, you know, how much are you just recording what's going on or how much are you manipulating it? And, you know, these incredible discussions. This one guy, I think it was in Florida somewhere, sort of kind of small paper, but went out and took a picture of a burning building. And it was a pretty intense scene, you know, it was just kind of local news, you know, I don't think anybody got hurt, but, you know, here was this building burning and he got this great picture of a fireman up in the ladder, you know, sort of spraying this building. And he came back and when he sort of really looked at the pictures, it didn't get the intensity that was there. And so he just made it more an orange background. All he did was really change the color of the background and wanted to intensify it and, you know, just sort of look more dramatic with the kind of Photoshop changes. And he actually felt like it was more in tune with what he actually saw rather than what was there in the digital bits on his camera. And he got fired for it, for manipulating this picture. And it became this kind of, you know, interesting kind of study in, you know, how do we record reality? What are our ethics of recording the world out there? And how, you know, how do we ever be true to that? So I'm sort of been, you know, continually interested in that. How do we get an ethical sense of this as an ethical film viewers? You know, I there's just no question that Hollywood has continued to be racist and sexist and homophobic and, you know, just sort of moving, you know, incredible amounts of our cultural, you know, our cultural, our sort of morality, you know, of how we engage with each other is deeply influenced. So I think there's a, you know, part of me, I'm happy to sort of be, you know, someone who sort of wants to resist that and try to get my students to kind of resist the, you know, heteronormative kinds of ideas that you get in Hollywood again and again, and try to be, you know, not passive consumers, but, you know, sort of active participants, which doesn't mean you can't enjoy the films by any means, but there can be other ways to do. So by visual ethics, I'm interested in, you know, being an active, critical viewer and participant in films, to think about what's going on as far as, you know, especially race and class and sex and gender, how these things get portrayed on film and how we might think about them, you know, differently. So, you know, be able to come away from a film and say, well, that was good here and there, but, you know, this part was a little bit problematic. And yeah, I bring that up in relation, for example, to The Matrix in my book. And, you know, I like The Matrix. I show it to my classes all the time. And it's interesting mixture of mythology. So you've got the Christian mythology and you've got this Buddhist mythology and they're sort of kind of woven together. So Neo is both this bodhisattva character as well as this messianic character. And he sort of kind of, you know, plays between the two mythologies. And then there's a couple other things mixed in there too. So, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful film as far as, you know, mixing all these things together. But then in the end, of course, it's the same kind of thing. You start out with a strong black man and a strong woman, you know, in the form of, you know, truly it's Trinity, played by Carrie Ann Moss and Lawrence Fishburne's character of Morpheus. The two of them are the strong ones and the knowledgeable ones in the beginning. And then in the end, it just turns around. So it's this, you know, Keanu Reeves, the good-looking white guy, you know, comes in and saves the day. He's just totally clueless and everything, but in the end, somehow the black man and the woman are just props for the good looking white guy again. And he's the one who really saves everybody. I just think, okay, this, you know, here's this great film and all this wonderful stuff going on, all this kind of alternative worlds and alternative realities. And then it just falls back in the same old Hollywood myth, right? Of black man, white woman saved the good looking white guy. And the Hollywood myth triumphs over any of the Buddhist and Christian sort of myths in the end. So thinking, so part of it is, I think, is just a little bit of kickback, a little bit of critical resistance to some of those conclusions that get drawn in Hollywood. And then the other side is, you know, I think visual ethics, and I bring out the idea of the face and the close-up and sort of engaging with film, you know, allowing oneself to be drawn into the film and seeing what film allows us is to see something that, you know, we can't possibly see with unaided human eye. It's a created world, and it brings worlds of far away to us in the here and now. And I think allowing ourselves, you know, a suspension of disbelief and allowing ourselves to be transported is important at the same time. So I'm really, you know, kind of talking about a push and pull at the same time. You know, it shouldn't just be totally critical where I just walk away disgusted with every film, but I also shouldn't just let myself be drawn into everything as well. So I think a certain amount of, you know, sort of an old believer in education and being able to practice these kinds of things that might bring us to a better state of film viewing. And, you know, ultimately it'd be wonderful if we'd have some impact on kinds of films Hollywood makes. And, you know, just every year, you know, we get this new batch of questions, you know, well, where are all the female directors in Hollywood? You know, and it's sort of like Catherine Bigelow comes along and wins an award one year and it's great. And then it's like, well, same old thing next year. And, you know, it's all the people up are, you know, are men. You know, it's a industry dominated by, you know, white men and white men's sort of views of the world that, I think it's, you know, it's time for a lot of that to change, and change is slow in coming, but it's happening.
Sure. In the last chapter, you have this phrase, the film has left the movie theater. And I'm wondering if you could kind of elaborate on this idea.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, think about it's one thing to look at films and to analyze their, you know, narrative content, do a formal analysis of films and say this happened and this happened and here's what this means. But then to sort of think about how that comes off the screen and impacts our everyday lives. And, you know, there's been some movement in this, especially in film studies, sort of social scientific approaches, kind of doing, you know, various questionnaires and trying to do this. But they're just always fairly unsatisfying, I think, to most people who look at them, because they, you know, they don't, you get this range of responses. But, you know, it's really hard to, because I think the thing is people don't really get exactly what goes on in the movie theater. And, you know, nobody's really clear how it actually impacts us. I mean, I very rarely could come out of a film and say, you know, here's what I got, you know, here's what happened to me. And so I try to take a little bit different approach, because I think it's important not just to sort of say, well, I'm going to interpret the Matrix for you and show you that, you know, by wearing leather, they were saying this and that, when, you know, 95% of the people who watched the Matrix didn't get that at all. And, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, I wanted to sort of think about what people did do with movies, you know, how they impact us. So my take on it was to, you know, explore various cultural manifestations of the movies and how they've, you know, directly influenced, gone back and changed the way religion operates. And so, you know, looked at a number of ways, you know, bar and bat mitzvahs and baptisms and weddings and these, you know, these general, you know, religious rituals, I mean, arguably sort of cultural rituals, but the way they've been impacted by film in a variety of ways. So everything from the, you know, you can get a Star Wars wedding done, you know, sort of theme wedding of Star Wars, or, you know, they did the Terminator, Bar Mitzvah, and things like that. So the way these films sort of impact, here's people, some very significant times in people's lives. And, granted, maybe a 12-year-old, has a limited idea of what the world is all about and what's important to them. And so the Terminator or Star Wars might be really what they're about. Of course, the funny thing is the Woody Allen, I can't remember which Woody Allen film it was, but where he actually had a portrayed within his film, actually had the Star Wars Bar Mitzvah, and those, the little boy cutting his cake with a lightsaber and things like that. It was just quite funny. But these things do go on, in everyday life. These kinds of a former student of mine sent me a picture a couple years ago. Her brother had gotten married, and they did a Matrix style, and they all wore these leather outfits and sunglasses to the wedding. they do have, maybe that's partly trivial, but the fact is, again, at some point, wedding's a fairly important thing, in contemporary life, and a pretty important decision and activity, and people are deciding to, make it turn the wedding ritual itself into the theme of a particular movie. I think it's kind of telling. And so it kind of invents, film. I mean, just sort of a number of these kinds of examples. Part of what I wanted to show is that, it has this impact in our culture and on our religious life and our sense of rituals. So the midnight movie kind of phenomenon of Rocky Horror Picture Show and films like that, where people go again and again and they dress up for it. And they, or the opening of the, the latest Harry Potter installment or Lord of the Rings installment, they always do these sort of midnight movies and everybody dresses up and you go and you stand in line, and it's this ritual that occurs. People sort of in our kind of quasi-secular world, people looking for a sense of belonging, a sense of identity, and not that somebody's going to say I am Bilbo Boggins, but there's a sense of community that's built, and people love to do this kind of stuff, and film cinema provides that context, I think, for so many people these days, that it's a fascinating phenomenon that how things revolve around films. If you go to the New Zealand Tourist Board, the official New Zealand Board of Tourism, if you go to their site online, right at the homepage is tours of Middle Earth you can find, and the tourist industry in New Zealand has gone up, a huge percentage after the Lord of the Rings. They build themselves as because so many of us know that Lord of the Rings was filmed in New Zealand. And so if I really want to visit Middle Earth, I have to go to New Zealand, forget the fact that, it's a fantasy story about a place that doesn't actually exist. People are spending thousands of dollars to fly to New Zealand to tour Middle Earth. I mean, granted, it's a beautiful place, sure, and I'd want to go there just to see it. But, it films change our cultural landscapes in this way, and we go on pilgrimages to various sites to stand where Bilbo once stood, that kind of thing, or stand where Rocky once stood. I start off the final chapter looking at the footsteps of Rocky. And at the top of the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art are in bronze are these Converse high top tread marks. And it's like Rocky stood here. And they're actually there. There's actually a physical place at the top of the stairs, overlooking downtown Philadelphia. And it's, because that's where this great scene in the first Rocky Sylvester Stallone movie, he goes running up the stairs and he stands at the top and he, waves his arm in the air. And so people from all over the world will come and stand in those footsteps and get pictures of themselves taken. You go online and just find hundreds and hundreds of pictures from people from China and India and Africa and Europe and all across the United States. They want to go and stand where Rocky once stood. Now, of course, it says Rocky, in the floor, but of course, Rocky's a character on film. It's not a real person. It was Sylvester Stallone playing the role of Rocky. So there's these layers of fiction that we just sort of collapse to the point where I want to get my picture taken where Rocky was, got his picture taken. So film has this, you know, impact. It changes our physical life. It's, trying to make the point in several different ways that it's not just separable. We can't just go to the theaters and come out of it and wash it off and say, oh, yeah, I'm now back in the real world. These things are just much more overlapping. And so I try to play with some of the ways that these overlaps happen between the two worlds, the world on screen and the world off screen.
Yeah, and you do this very successfully, I think, and I think that's one of the at least for me, a novice in the field, seems to be a good shift away from let's read the meaning of this film the same way I'd read the meaning of this text, and let's see how this is all coming together in kind of a lived reality. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your role with the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, which is really taking this idea of film as a key medium for understanding religion. Could you talk a little bit about what the journal is doing and your role in that?
Amir Hussein came on board as the general editor of JAR, of Journal of American Academy of Religion, two years ago now. And Amir's always been interested in film, and actually was one of the people leading the religion, film, and visual culture group for several years. Was the chair of that group for several years, along with John Lydon. And he teaches courses in religion and film and these kinds of things. He does Islam as well, but general courses in religion and film. So he's always had this kind of visual interest and visual bent. And so when he came on board, he wanted to, beef up the visual dimensions. And so he's put in, some photo essays. And like last issue, we had this great artist, Sandow Burke, did several of his pieces from the American Quran series that Burke is working on right now. And then he asked John Lydon and I to come on board and to kind of oversee some, I think we're calling them media essays. It's hard to come up with the right term that would be kind of inclusive, but not open to everything either. So really kind of asked me to kind of edit, seek out some people and edit some people or edit the work of some people to create short essays, around 3,000 or 4,000 words. They're not sort of full on articles, but, bigger than just, don't want just a film review, because that doesn't work either. So trying to insert, the importance of these visual dimensions within the study of religion. So John Lydon contributed one on Star Wars, sort of the after effects of Star Wars, what happens when, it's kind of like I was doing in my fourth chapter, what happens when film comes off the screen. John sort of argues for the way Star Wars came off the screen and how it looks like a religion, not because what, not arguing whether or not Obi-Wan Kenobi or Luke Skywalker is a messianic figure, or whether the Force is as the Tao or something like that, but that it's a religion because people follow it like a religion, and the arguments, endless arguments over certain scenes within Star Wars, and the sort of almost Talmudic argumentation that goes on about what really happened in these specific scenes in Star Wars. So it's a great kind of audience response to Star Wars and arguing for the religiousness thereof. Elijah Sigler just did a piece in the most recent one on David Cronenberg's films, and sort of arguing for Cronenberg as a secular auteur, and that we need to, in religious studies, we need to think about what it would mean to have a secular film. And in some ways, the point is that it's really an anomaly, to have a very secular film. There are, so many films that are so infused with religious, it may just be symbolism. It may just be a one-off kind of thing to sort of encapsulate some ideas. But nonetheless, it's sort of, they're based on these ancient mythological and ritualistic structures that it's almost, I would argue that it's almost impossible to get away from religion film. When you look at most films around the world, I would argue that there's sort of religious bases for the creation of film itself. So Cronenberg, is really in some ways, as Ziegler tries to argue, getting away from all that and trying to create a real, truly secular film. So a variety of ways. And I did a piece on based on the Tree of Life, based on Terrence Malick's Tree of Life, but looking at the way the Tree of Life has functioned in mythological structures visually throughout history, including Charles Darwin's own Origin of the Species draws a Tree of Life diagram for that and introduce this idea of natural selection. So, you know, how this sort of this ancient mythological symbol shows up again and again, and then how Terrence Malick is just, in a sense, one of many people using this visual image, this visual symbol to help create the mythology of the film. So, you know, trying to approach a variety of ways that images and especially visual are moving images. I'm trying to get a piece going on video games right now and thinking about video games and the images therein and how they function within our lives. So trying to get away from just interpreting a film and giving a formal analysis of a film, but trying to think about it in relation to culture and in relation to religious structures in one way or another. That's the kind of goal of the AAR journal, trying to get those essays going.
Yeah, you guys have done a great job so far. Before I let you go, Brent, could you just briefly tell us about what you're working on now or what might be coming out in the future?
Currently I'm doing a book that really has nothing to do with film. I'm sort of happy to say I'm ready to get away from film, I think, for a little bit and do some other stuff. I'm writing a book for Beacon Press. Should be hopefully completed in the spring. It's called A History of Religion in 5½ Objects. And I look at sort of the material, you know, again, the kind of sense-based ways we engage objects. So the objects are crosses, incense, bread, drums, and stones. Each one has a connection to one of the five senses. And I look at sort of cross-cultural inter-religious kinds of ways that stones show up, for instance, their use in as cairns, the way they, you know, sort of function in ancient structures like in Stonehenge, as well as more kind of personal ways people might collect a stone from some place they've been and bring it back with them as a kind of memento of life. So looking at these objects, these specific kind of objects across religious traditions and how they've meant different things in different places, and, you know, ultimately implicitly arguing that this is the stuff of religion. This is, you know, religion begins with these material engagements.
Great. Well, I appreciate your time, and thanks again. The book really, I think, adds a lot to the conversation and makes it very accessible for newbies. So thank you.
Good. You bet. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Brent Plate about his new book, Religion and Film, Cinema and the Recreation of the World, which came out in 2008 from Wallflower Press.